All right. End of lunch. Thank you for coming back from the pool. Appreciate it. I saw everybody going out earlier with their boxed lunches to the pool, and yeah. We're going to go ahead and get started because we just want to try to stay on time, so I'm just going to ask people to find their seats. Awesome, thank you. So it's really my pleasure to introduce Jeremiah Johnson, and he's going to be talking with us today about paradigm shifting. When treatment is prevention, what then do we mean by prevention? And the reason I'm really excited to have Jeremiah with us today is, as many of you know, he's part of the Treatment Action Group and really is the first HIV prevention research and policy coordinator as part of TAG, which is a really important shift and a recognition of kind of the changes that we've had over the last several years. I know Jeremiah from work that we've done in trying to really piece out a prevention cascade. And TAG has done a tremendous amount of work in leading that charge and really keeping the emphasis on not only really optimizing treatment for prevention, but making sure that we continue to keep the same aggressive focus on keeping people who are HIV negative, HIV negative. So without further ado, I will hand it over to Jeremiah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. thank you so much for the introduction, Reve. There's the slide. So as Reve already said, my name is Jeremiah Johnson. I am indeed the first HIV prevention research and policy coordinator at Treatment Action Group. It's a really long title, so I feel very important. I do in fact work at Treatment Action Group. And it will be my pleasure to talk to you this afternoon about paradigm shifting. There's been just a lot of change, of course, around HIV prevention in the last 11 years, and so I think a lot of us are trying to wrap our heads around this, and TAG's been trying to take a lead on a lot of that to put some new ideas forth for everybody. So really honored to be able to talk about that. Very quickly, I have no conflict of interest to disclose. And just very quickly, Treatment Action Group is an independent research and policy think tank focused on activism to accelerate research, treatment, access, and community information to prevent, treat, and cure HIV and its most common co-infections, hepatitis C and tuberculosis. So we keep ourselves busy. And I don't know if Dr. Young has made it back yet or not. I'll save the comment that I have for him for a little bit then, and dive in. I'm honored to be able to talk about this both from sort of a professional and a personal perspective. HIV has been, it's played such a major role in terms of my recent career, of course, but also on a personal level. And I spend a lot of time thinking about all of this because there is so much change. It really is such an exciting time in terms of HIV prevention compared to what we used to know it as. What we used to know it as is sort of being, you know, a really awkward test that you had once in a while, coupled with some really probing questions about how many people you've had sex with and, you know, your condom usage, and then a fistful of condoms, maybe lube if you were lucky, and then sent out the door. So to see how much has changed in recent years is really exciting. Starting from having the first CDC PEP guidelines for non-occupational exposure in 2005, the advent of PrEP, of course, in 2012, approved by the FDA, TASP 2011, HPT and 052 coming through. We've seen the epidemic in a completely new way in that time with the advent of the Gardner Cascade and the Care and treatment continuum, which is mandatory for all of us to have multiple times at every HIV-related event that we ever go to. And it's completely transformed that. And so that's changed it. While not specific to HIV, of course, we have the Affordable Care Act. And I should preface this by saying I do a lot of work domestically on HIV, so a lot of my discussion will focus on that, but hopefully there's a lot here for people more internationally focused as well. But here in the U.S., that is transforming what we can really offer in terms of HIV prevention and just overall health and wellness for vulnerable communities. And then, of course, there's renewed urgency for older effective tools that we've had, renewed urgency for syringe access programs and options for people who inject, especially following what the outbreak that we saw in Scott County, Indiana, last year. So it's an active time, it's an exciting time, but personally, I'm very happy to see all of these options because for me, you know, I received my own HIV diagnosis back in 2008, and I can't help but think if I had had a pill available that I could take every single day, I probably wouldn't be HIV positive now. And if I had had greater access to PEP, I wonder if that could have helped bridge that gap in order to actually avoid HIV in the first place. So this is something that's really meaningful to me and gets me really fired up and excited about all of the choices that we have. In terms of looking nationally, however, in the U.S., in terms of you know, where we're putting our resources, where we're being most aggressive in terms of policy scale-up, while there has been a lot of movement on all of these different options, and especially we've seen a lot of advocacy growing around PrEP, really, so much of the national response in the U.S. has been very TASP-centric. Right from the get-go, as was brought up earlier today, we saw us go, saw the U.S. calling for a test-and-treat approach in the U.S., despite the fact that it wasn't totally clear at that point whether there was a health benefit for the HIV-positive individual. So it was very aggressive at that time to move that direction. We saw the introduction of high-impact prevention at the CDC, and we saw some of the limited prevention dollars that were available, a huge chunk of that actually get moved toward prevention for HIV-positive people, sort of diminishing what we were spending, the percentage that we were spending on prevention for negatives. And there were a lot of questions about where we were headed in terms of all of that. And in so many ways, that aggressive scale-up has made a lot of sense. You know, thanks to a lot of the modeling of people who are here today, you know, there is this theoretical notion, because TASP is just so effective, that if we were able to test every single HIV-positive person in the U.S. and around the globe tomorrow, get them onto treatment, and help them adhere, of course, to treatment, that we could end the epidemic tomorrow, and it's extremely exciting. And by doing so, we would also obviate some of the real complications around all of the notion of increasing prevention for negatives, because we're just poised a little bit better around care and treatment as prevention. As you see on the graph here from the Kaiser Family Foundation, this mirrors a lot of where HIV funding has been in the U.S. For a while, so we have a lot going to care and treatment already. To where, for in terms of federal funding, we've been drawing for prevention for HIV-negative people from that small sliver of 3% of the domestic HIV/AIDS budget to try and scale up interventions there. And as I said, from my high-impact prevention, we've seen that even begin to diminish how much we're putting there. So there just already better structures in place. It's not nearly as controversial to get people onto treatment. PrEP is still a bit controversial in some ways, in some circles. And advocacy is just more developed around care and treatment. As was alluded to, TAG just added my position back in 2013. But prior to that, it really was a lot of care and treatment advocacy instead. So in so many ways, this has made sense. But for myself and for a number of my colleagues at TAG, we have some arguments that really call that approach into question for us. And you know, for me, I just hope that we're prioritizing primary prevention to the same degree that we're prioritizing secondary prevention. And one argument, of course, is that the notion that TASP alone can end an HIV epidemic, particularly among men who have sex with men where the reproductive rate is so high, is still controversial. We're seeing some examples on one side, some examples on the other side, but the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of debate about to what degree do acutely infected individuals drive forward the epidemic. If it's sort of situation A, in this graph that comes from a paper by Kim Powers from a few years ago, where it's a little more even, then it doesn't matter as much that it takes us time to test people, get them onto treatment, and get them virally suppressed. And so tests can be more effective. But if it's situation B, then we might be limited in what we're able to do on that. So from a public health perspective, at this point, it's a bit of a gamble from our perspective. Not unrealistic necessarily, but just controversial. But for me personally, and I think for those who have a bit more of a human rights approach to all of this, there are some ethical considerations to look at. One of which was brought up a little bit by Bob Remian this morning and talking about his own personal experience in trying to go on to treatment. And not to pick on you, Bob, but it was a point I was going to make anyway. That even those of us who are really well linked in the HIV world, sometimes we need time between the news that we need to go on to treatment to actually getting on to treatment. And so what does it actually mean? How does it actually impact our communities to place the burden of ending an epidemic on the shoulders of HIV-positive individuals? And I don't think there's an easy or simple answer to that, but something to consider. On the other side of it, I keep going back to my 19-year-old self, walking in and receiving an HIV negative test, but having it very clear that condoms and behavioral interventions were not going to work for me, and they were never going to work for me. And I think about, how much evidence we have, the growing evidence we have that it doesn't work for a number of people. And I think about, young people walking in terrified, getting that test, terrified of getting HIV, and not having the full range of options that they need in order to avoid HIV. And so, on that individual level, TASP is not going to do a lot for that person anytime soon. And I believe that because of that, because of where we've been, and because of the impact that this epidemic has on people, both HIV negative and HIV positive, we have an absolute obligation to go aggressively after both primary and secondary prevention. And so that's a lot of what we talk about at Treatment Action Group. We need equitable access to all of the tools in our toolbox, and that's for all communities that are disproportionately affected by this. We can't allow PrEP to become privileged prevention. We need to ensure, because not all interventions are created equal, everybody deserves access to all of these options. End of story. I realize that there are a lot of complications in trying to scale it up, but the fact of the matter is there's no good reason that someone who is highly vulnerable shouldn't be able to walk in to a provider's office and receive access to every single option that they have. There's no good reason. There are a lot of companies making a lot of money off of this epidemic, and I would rather that we prioritize access rather than what our shareholders are earning off of it. We also need to continue to pursue hopeful new tools in the pipeline. We need options. People need lots of options. We know this from, in terms of birth control and contraception. We need lots and lots of options. And so we need to continue to invest aggressively in injectables and microbicides, particularly options that work for cisgender women. That's very important. That's something that we keep seeing over and over again, that we're not there yet. And then, of course, we have to keep investing in vaccines and cures, because ending AIDS as a public health threat is a lovely notion. Ending AIDS AIDS is never going to end for me until we have a cure, for me personally. So, you know, it's important to keep all of these things that we're going just as aggressively after that. We need to maximize the impact of the Affordable Care Act to ensure that the structural interventions that have been handed to us, we're taking full advantage of that. We need to understand, to what degree are people paying out of pocket for PrEP? What is the actual prevention benefit that people are getting from getting on private insurance through the exchanges? And that's a question that we think is really important that we're looking at. And of course, we're going to need to expand Medicaid if we have any hopes of realistically bringing the epidemic below epidemic levels anytime soon. Something that we're urging at TAG and a lot of people in this room are urging is that we have to treat HIV prevention and primary prevention with the same level of respect that we do care and treatment, and treat it like the complex field that it is. It is no longer just a simple process of counseling, testing, and referral, and a fistful of condoms, and that's it. This is a complex field. We have many different interventions. We need to continue to understand how they roll out in different populations, how they affect different populations. And, as one example here, I've included a slide from Albert Liu, who is here, looking at the PrEP demo project that took place in San Francisco and Miami and Washington, D.C. And, of course, we saw big differences among different populations and in different geographic regions. So we need to understand what are those differences, but more importantly, what are the interventions that are going to get us around that? Because we really need to address those disparities. Now, far be it from me to simply describe the problem and all of the questions. I think it's very easy for that to take place. We get really intimate, really good knowledge about what the problem is, but not necessarily into what some of the solutions are. And so I'm proud to say that over the past 2.5 years at TAG, I've worked with a tremendous team. I've had the privilege of working to convene a number of amazing community members, a number of people from academia, service providers, of course, and members of government, to try and piece together what are the research and implementation priorities that we need to look at if we're going to go just as aggressively after primary prevention as we are for secondary prevention right now. And I only have one copy for me here. It's fabulous. It's blue. I love blue. I might be a little bit biased, but I think you should all check it out. There's a lot of great information in there, and it is available on our website. But just to give you an overview of some of the recommendations that we have in there, a lot of them fit into sort of 5 primary recommendations that we've been looking at. So I'll go over that, and hopefully these are some things that you can take with you in terms of some things that we can be moving forward on, especially in terms of advocacy, and I believe that we all are advocates in this room to some degree. So the first is that we need to continue to strengthen our surveillance, and in particular around prevention for HIV-negative people. If we don't know where we're at in the epidemic, if we don't have a real working map, then it becomes really challenging learning where we're going and what we need to be doing. And so at TAG, we very much believe that we need to continue to press for HIV incidence estimates that are accurate and timely. We organizationally believe that HIV diagnoses are a poor proxy for HIV incidence, and so we think that we need to continue to press for that. We need to continue to seek out ways to understand surveillance around the different HIV prevention interventions that we have. So looking at how many people are accessing PrEP, how does that vary amongst demographics, and not being just PrEP specific. There are a lot of great innovative ideas that are being promoted here around sorts of metrics and PrEP cascades and all sorts of stuff. Really proud of Colorado for showing up. I'm from Colorado originally, so I'm very proud of them showing up for that. But we need to even go beyond that into something. We need to look for new metrics to understand comprehensive prevention to what degree are people accessing all of the options that they need? And then a third part to the surveillance that's extremely important to me, and something that I talk about a lot, is we need to ensure that all of our populations are visible in the data. As of right now, there are a number of populations that just aren't showing up enough. We still struggle to get good information on youth. We still struggle to get good information on incarcerated populations, on homeless and transitionally housed, sex workers. And then for me personally, the fact that we are well into our fourth decade of this epidemic, and we continue to lump transgender women with men who have sex with men and underreport information, not have information on trans men, to me is absolutely appalling. And if public health malpractice were a thing, I think that would be a real candidate for that. So I think, thank you. So we need to be strengthening our surveillance. So that's number one. Number two, we need to continue to identify and support research priorities to better define evidence-based prevention practices and implementation science. We've seen a lot of great work being done in the demo projects around PrEP. There's a lot of innovative sort of thinking around all of that, really forward thinking with some of the new things that are coming down the pipeline, including injectables. I know Sarit Golub in New York is getting some funding to look at implementation science before we even have the intervention, which is, you know, I think great, and something we've really learned from PrEP. But we at TAG believe that we need a national implementation science agenda, a real strategic, comprehensive sort of look at what are the gaps that we need to understand in taking some of these different interventions from the science to actually being out in the real world. And we're starting to do it with PrEP. We need to do it more with sort of packaged, comprehensive HIV prevention out there. Number three, we propose that we form a federal comprehensive HIV prevention service delivery initiative, similar to the HIV Care Continuum Initiative, to identify and coordinate cross-agency responsibilities to address critical structural, social, and behavioral determinants of health and HIV risk reduction in key vulnerable populations. We hear a lot of the priorities at ONAP and the White House in terms of trying to deal with the disparities on the care and treatment side of things. Absolutely super duper important. We want to see that same level of scaling up and prioritizing for comprehensive prevention also for HIV negative individuals. It's absolutely essential. And so we believe that we need a similar initiative on that side of things. Number four, a number of people that we consulted asked that we develop, disseminate, and support best HIV prevention practices to facilitate comprehensive, culturally competent, streamlined, age-appropriate, and rapid uptake among non-HIV care and other service providers. And that's because everyone in this room is very busy. People working at community-based organizations, AIDS service organizations, providing prevention services are very busy, and there's been a lot that's changed, and we really need simple sort of checklists, simple guidelines, things that we're really actively promoting to help people really understand what are the best practices now in this new era of HIV prevention. We've seen some really great examples. I think the CDC PrEP guidelines that came out in 2014 are a great example of that. The New York State Department of Health issued some additional guidelines and checklists for people prescribing PrEP to people. So we just need to get better at sharing those even more so, and really challenging ourselves to bridge it to comprehensive prevention, and also bridge it into broader wellness, health, and happiness. So we need to work on that. And then finally, number five, this is something that I'll spend the rest of the time talking a lot about, and I think the actual reason I was brought here to talk about this is we need to be looking into developing continua, process models, or similar heuristics to guide comprehensive HIV prevention service delivery research and implementation. And this comes from the notion that, you know, all of that we saw with the Gardner Cascade, all that we saw with the care and treatment continuum, it was a uniquely galvanizing visual. It was something that we were all, it made intuitive sense. It really simplified a complex and dynamic process. It really gave us some really clear metrics and endpoints that we could understand. It was easy to reproduce. And because it captured so much attention, it galvanized that advocacy, funding, and implementation of sound research policies and best practices. In a similar way, we're asking, is it time for a prevention continuum that gets that widely distributed to that same degree? Because, again, sometimes I think we get a little bit stuck in how are we fitting all of these pieces of the puzzle together at this point. I think for some of us, we're talking about this a lot, and so we're very familiar with it. But for others, you know, we need something that can really get out there on the front lines that a lot of people, you know, not just at this conference, but elsewhere, can access it and really understand what is the pathway when you have someone who gets an HIV negative test but is highly vulnerable to infection. And we also need to have some sort of visual, something that can help us to look at these missed opportunities in terms of insurance navigation and enrollment. You know, in the post-ACA era, there's a lot that we can do with someone who's highly vulnerable after a test. It doesn't just have to be what it's been in the past. We can do, and it doesn't even have to be just HIV specific. We can do a lot. Risk assessments for HIV and other health disparities, linkage to HIV inclusive, comprehensive care, coordination of various interventions. So that's been something that's really been at the heart of a lot of work that we've been doing at TAG for the past 3 years, is to try and move the bar on this at least a little bit. We're not the only smart people who think we can do this. There are lots of smart people working on this. And of course, each different cascade and continuum that has been presented out there has its own benefits to the field, and has its own has messages that we've been drawing from, and we've been trying to pull from all of this to really come up with something that fits all of our priorities and all of the priorities of the people we've been consulting. So, of course, there have been intervention-based cascades. We've seen a lot of this starting to go on in terms of looking at PrEP in particular and its uptake on for HIV-negative individuals. We've had population-based cascades and prevention continua that look a little bit more like what we see on the care and treatment side of things, discrete bars that you're moving through in terms of interventions. One thing that the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene has provided us with is what they call an HIV-neutral continuum of care. And something that we've liked about this is that by sort of sandwiching together the care and continuum on the right-hand side and a separate sort of continuum for HIV-negative individuals, it drives home that point that ending the epidemic is all of our responsibility and something that we're all, it's all sort of the same. Complex process that's paired together. And then, of course, we have the extremely innovative and very interesting and fantastic model by Ravet and her team, looking at, sort of at how the virus actually, you know, the infection cascade and how the virus sort of travels from the community actually down into the point of viral infection, and inserting some of the different tools that we have to see where we're able to actually block that at different steps. Sort of a various soup of structural and social things there at the bottom. So drawing from all of this, Tim Horn, the HIV project director at TAG, actually first came up with this model. This is what we've been working with for a while. It's a double helix comprehensive HIV prevention process model. It's had a lot of strengths in it, and it's done a lot of the things that we've really wanted this kind of visual to do. So one, it sort of pairs the HIV positive and HIV negative. It's very relatable, it's very familiar, and it sort of shows that after an HIV positive or an HIV negative test, there are sort of similar steps that you need to go through in terms of supporting that individual to either become virally suppressed or to maintain their HIV negative status. So a lot of strengths. That's not showing up as well as I thought it would, but I'll translate. We see it as accessible, relatable. It prioritizes linkage to insurance and care. It's not HIV specific. You actually can tie that to a broader sort of health and wellness model. And it demands coordination of interventions and services. But some of the feedback that we've gotten from people is, that there are certain weaknesses. Is prevention really linear? With care and treatment, of course, we're all going sort of to the same end point, really. We want viral suppression. If you're doing HIV prevention for HIV-negative people, maybe it's a bit more cyclical. Maybe it's something where the test is the focal point, and you keep coming back to that HIV test, but the needs and the outcomes of that change with each cycle. And so that was one feedback that we got back, from people. We also got a lot of feedback from people that it focuses a little too heavily on a medical model, perhaps. As we heard from our patient panel earlier today, AIDS service organizations and community-based organizations are still providing some of the only specialized expertise for people in sort of a... meeting some of the more social supportive needs that people have, and sort of having a specialized knowledge of different highly impacted communities. So we need a concept that also includes CBOs and ASOs. And so if we go a little bit more to a test-specific sort of focus, rather than that linkage and medicalized model, maybe that might be better. I think that's... that's about all I can read, so we'll just move on. Through all of that, we have come up with a new model. This is our teaser slide for it. This is sort of, this is our Beyoncé Lemonade teaser. But the full HBO session, you're going to have to hold on to, because we have submitted this for publication. I can't give everything away right now. So you'll learn about Becky with the good hair later. But it is a conceptual model where HIV testing is a focal point, and so that's one thing we've drawn from. We've worked to try and identify the different elements marrying the testing, primary prevention, the secondary prevention into one graph, and we've started to put together some ideas about what are some of the key metrics that we need to be looking at? What are some of the innovative ways that we can start to obtain measurements for those metrics? And what are some potential data sources that we could start to draw from for different points along the process? So we're very excited, and I encourage you to keep an eye out for that. And hopefully this discussion will help to frame a little bit more about what we talk about this afternoon for the HIV prevention continuum and some of the other presentations. Before I cede my time, two things. One, I personally try to challenge myself, and I try to challenge everybody. I think sometimes the tendency to get really bogged down in just wanting to focus on TASP alone, or to really feel much more optimistic about that, is because it's just so it's daunting to think about what we have to do for comprehensive HIV prevention for negatives. There's so much work to be done. We just don't have everything in place that we need. And I think we get caught up in some of the realism, some of the pragmatism, Congress is never going to give us new funding for HIV prevention anytime soon, all of that. But regardless of that, I think that everyone in this room, and myself included, we need to start by being idealists. We need to start by being activists and remembering that these structures weren't in place for care and treatment at one time. They had to be fought for. They had to be fought for hard. And there is just as much urgency, and we need to maintain that urgency to fight for similar structures for people who are HIV negative. We need to be shooting for Mars, and then maybe we'll end up on the moon, and hopefully we can start to really provide real options for people who are HIV negative to the same degree that we're trying to do for care and treatment as prevention. So that's all my presentation. I do want to, now that Dr. Ben Young is in the room, I would be remiss in not commenting on sort of a meaningful synchronicity that has taken place here today. Bob Rimian talked a lot this morning in his presentation about the importance of a meaningful physician connection with their patient and what you can actually achieve through that. And about 8 years ago, I stumbled into Dr. Ben Young's office after my own HIV diagnosis, and it was an incredibly difficult time. He was my first infectious disease doctor. I had gotten kicked out of the Peace Corps for testing HIV positive, so I was reeling from that as well. And I was so lucky to encounter not just a purveyor of information on treatment and the basic logistics of HIV, but a caring and unique physician who took the time to explain the lived experience of HIV for me, the lived experience for my family even, and so much of why I'm able to do the advocacy that I am today is because of supportive people, including Dr. Ben Young, and to share a stage with you 8 years later is meaningful beyond words. So with that, I will cede my time. Thank you.